Hey folks, and welcome back to the High Performance Human Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Ward, founder of thetriathloncoach.com, High Performance Human, and the SWOT Inner Circle. And I am on a mission to help you upgrade your human performance with improved sleep, nutrition, fitness, mobility, and stress management. If you can do one of those, you'll be on the pathway to living longer, living healthier, and of course, improving your athletic performance. If you're interested in joining me on this journey, please check out my SWOT Inner Circle, where you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. Please just email Beth at thetriathloncoach.com or look for the link in the show notes below. Now, my guest on today's show is Dr. Jeffrey Sankoff, an ER physician and triathlete from Denver, Colorado. He's been a triathlete for over 20 years, and he also works part-time as a triathlon coach, aka TriDoc, for the last 5 years. Since January 2020, he's also been working on the front line at Denver Health in the battle against coronavirus. And all of these experiences gathered make him uniquely placed to understand the effects of COVID on endurance athletes. And he's written extensively on this subject over the last year for Training Peaks and Triathlon Magazine, to name a few. Jeffrey also specializes in studying the research on health and exercise and translating this into trusted, easy to understand information that we can all use. As we come out of lockdown, we're all full of optimism for racing in the next few months and beyond, and Jeffrey and I discuss how you can avoid COVID until you've had the vaccine, recovering from COVID and return to training, what we know so far, and the TriDoc's advice based on his experience as a physician and triathlon coach. Also, is long COVID any different to post-viral syndrome after the flu? Post the vaccine, what habits and behaviours should endurance athletes continue with, and what habits and behaviours should we continue to avoid? On the health bell curve, where do triathletes generally sit? What has Jeffrey learned from the COVID pandemic as a physician, as a triathlete, and as a coach? His strategies for long-term health and exercise and ageing, and if we want to still be doing triathlon in our 70s, what should we be doing now? So, that's enough of an intro from me. Let's crack on with today's guest. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jeffrey Sankoff, all the way from Boulder, Colorado.
Denver, Colorado, actually, just outside of Boulder, but I am thrilled to be here.
Yeah, I just associate everywhere in Colorado with being Boulder now, because that's where most of my guests seem to come from.
With good reason. Boulder's actually a really nice place, and I wouldn't mind living there.
Yeah, well, I've been there a few times. Obviously, we're both well connected with the Training Peaks gang, and I'm the UK coach ambassador now, so I was intending to sort of mix two birds with one stone there and come over and spend a month there going skiing and a bit of time at Training Peaks, but that's not happened yet.
Well, we can look forward to that in a future time, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Well, so Jeff, there's lots of reasons why we've got you on the show today. One, you're obviously a Training Peaks colleague. You've written a lot with the blog, and we'll put a link to some of those blog posts that you've contributed there, because the content is great and will be of definite interest to some of our listeners. You are a triathlete and an accomplished Ironman triathlete. You're a coach, but you're also an emergency room physician. So that would be like an A&E consultant, would it, in the UK?
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what it is.
Okay, so, and you've been heavily involved in this whole COVID pandemic right from the word dot, and you were right there at day one, weren't you, with one of the very first people in the United States to be diagnosed with COVID?
Yeah, we didn't know at the time, but I early on, gosh, it must have been late January or early February, took care of a pilot who was flying for one of the cargo companies, and he had come back and had just been in Wuhan and had all the symptoms, but we didn't have the test at the time, and we just presumed that that's what he had, and it was pretty frightening, because we didn't know what we were dealing with, and we certainly knew we had to be careful and cautious, but we had no idea of what was coming. So yeah, it was, looking back, we had no idea that was really the beginning of what was soon to really overwhelm everyone.
Well, it's, as we're chatting now, it's the 8th of March. I think somewhere around the 20th, 25th, was probably when we went into our first lockdown. So we're almost 12 months into this. Nobody thought we'd be, you know, Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Really. Let's wind back a bit then from that. I guess medical career came first, did it, for you before triathlon?
Yeah, I had always wanted to be a physician, and early on had considered emergency medicine as a career before I really knew what it entailed, based mostly on things that I had seen on television, like so many other people. But once I got to medical school and was exposed to emergency medicine, it really was a career I was drawn to. And once I was in my residency, which I believe in Britain is called a registrar, I then pursued critical care as subspecialty training, so did an additional 2 years. And once I was coming to the end of that, was really terribly out of shape and terribly overweight, and made a decision that I had to change that because my family history was such that I was on course for early demise from cardiovascular disease. So started getting into shape and lost a lot of weight pretty quickly once I started eating better and started exercising. And a colleague of mine at kind of the welcome dinner for my new group in emergency medicine said to me, you know, so what are you doing? I see you're losing weight. Do you do any kind of exercise? And I explained what I was doing. And she said, well, you know, you might want to consider triathlon. And I laughed because that was not something I had ever considered or would ever consider. Because to me, triathlon was the only thing I knew, Ironman in Kona. And I said, oh, no, I have no interest in doing that crazy thing in Hawaii. And that started a conversation that, really my education of what triathlon really was. She spent a long time sort of telling me that, you know, triathlon wasn't just Ironman, and introducing me to this whole concept of different distances and how big of a sport it really was, that was just apparently under my nose and I had no idea. And so that led to a whole series of events that started with me learning how to swim. And next thing you know, I was a triathlete. But a year later, I did my first ever race and went on to do an Olympic as my goal in my first year. And I don't know, just, you know, like all like so many other triathletes, you know, one thing begets another. And I can remember saying over and over again, oh, I'm never going to do that next distance. And then next thing you know, you're doing that next distance. And it took a very long time. I had a family along the way. And so, you know, it wasn't like there was a straight line between starting the sport and getting to Kona. But after many, many years in the sport, made a decision that that was something I did want to do. And when I qualified, one of the first people I told was that woman who had first suggested to me that I try triathlon. And I called her up and reminded her of the conversation and said, guess where I'm going? So she was thrilled, as was I.
If we could all go back and find the person that planted that seed in our mind, I wonder what those conversations would be like.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be an interesting book, actually, wouldn't it? For the conversation of the with the person who put the idea into your mind.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, for many people, it's a one and done. A lot of people do this as kind of a bucket list thing. And once they've done it, they've scratched the itch and they're done. But for so many others, it really does become a lifestyle and becomes a big part of their lives. And certainly for me, it has. It changed my life like so many others. And it's been 20 years of it's just added so much for me and caused me to do so many other things that have brought me so much enjoyment.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I did my first triathlon back in 1987. It was the conversation I would be with the bar manager where I was working, or the owner of the bar where I was the manager. And I'd been in Australia and I came back and I'd heard about the Ironman triathlon. I'd probably seen the Julian Moss video like everybody else, seen some triathlons out in Australia. And we have a thing in the UK called Children in Need, where, you know, you raise money, you do these little events to raise money for children's charities, and it's become a huge annual event. And so I just said, yeah, I'm going to do a triathlon. And then I didn't even know where to find one, but found a little piece of paper, a flyer in a sports shop, and there we were. And that was the conversation I had with my bar manager. She said, you're the manager, you should do something different. So I did. Always like to be different. But So that's 34 years this September since I did my first triathlon. Yeah, it has. Like you, it's been part of my life. I've met some incredible people. You know, we were talking about Ironman Canada. I went there in 1995 to do my first Ironman. And one of the reasons I was going back was to meet some friends that I met there, you know, 27 years ago, who I still keep in touch with. And so it's been interesting to see all those journeys. So it's an amazing way to see places and meet people, isn't it? And have some new experiences.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've some of my best friends or friends I've made in the sport, and some of the best relationships are from the sport. So yeah, I couldn't agree more.
So you've been 20 years then. So your first triathlon was 2001?
Yep, 2001. I did my first sprint and went on. I kind of sequentially increased the distance. I did kind of a sprint and then a modified sprint that was a little bit longer. Mm. And then I finished that year with an Olympic. And I then realized the swim for me was the big problem. I was really had just learned how to swim just to do the triathlon. And I can't remember how I figured it out, but at some point I was looking at the half Ironman distance and realized that the swim was only 400 meters longer for the half Ironman from the Olympic. And so I said to myself, well, I can do that. So then the issue became the run, because I hadn't really been a runner before. And I said, well, I don't know if I could run a half marathon. So I made a deal with myself. I signed up for a half marathon. And I said, if I can run a half marathon in 1:45, I'll sign up for a half Ironman. And I remember training for that and thinking, gosh, this is really hard, and ended up doing it in like 1:43. And so that was it. The die was cast. And so I signed up for a half Ironman the next year and did that. And remembered thinking, of course, you know, oh, I'm never going to do that at double this distance. This is just fine. Mm. But, you know, of course, like everyone else, you know, because then what happens is, you know, you do your half Ironman and everybody says, oh, you're a triathlete. Have you done an Ironman? And if you say no, it's like, well, I guess I'm not really a triathlete. So then you do an Ironman and then everybody asks, oh, have you done the one in Hawaii? And until you've done an one in Hawaii, you feel like, well, I guess I'm not really an Ironman. So it's constantly trying to do. But now that I've finally done Hawaii, I feel like, okay, I've done them all, until people start asking, oh, when did you do it? And then I realize it's still, you know, the time since I've done it is marching forward, and I feel like I have to get back there.
That's And it seems like in the 30 years, I've noticed a definite change in triathlon. When I started out, there was absolutely that progression. Start off with a sprint or a standard, or there were hybrids then, so they didn't really have any names. There was Olympic distance, and you do that and you take your time building up. I think it was 8 years before I felt like I was, you know, I'd put in the place everything. I'd cycled 100 miles in a day, I'd run a marathon, I felt now I've done a half Ironman, I can put them all together and do the Ironman. And about 4 weeks before I went to Canada, I rode a 100-mile ride as my last one, and I got back and I could hardly walk. And I remember thinking, how am I going to get through 26 miles? And then on the day, it just, you know, that bit where, because the Canada run goes all the way out on the lake and down to OK Falls. And then as you come back, you've got a bit of a hill coming out there. And I remember thinking, you know, as we were running down that hill and my legs are cramping, I'm thinking, oh, I've got to get all the way back up here when we come back. And it just seemed interminably long all the way along by the lake. I mean, it's only made worse by the drag up to the airport, isn't it? Up to the Energy Lab. But anyway, you know, I finished it, and like you probably did, and everyone else, I said I'm never doing another one. But then the next morning, I was back filling my form in to go back to Canada the next year.
That's right.
And we'd all heard that story, hadn't we, of people in Canada being in the lineup wearing the kit that they'd finished in, but actually there were people dressed in their race kit waiting to enter.
Yeah, it really is addictive. I think, you know, you started that anecdote. I think you were going to say something about how people used to start short distances and then go to Ironman, but now people are starting off right away with Ironman. And and I think that is, it's good and it's bad. I think it's a testament to the fact that Ironman has just become, or, you know, World Triathlon Corporation has become such an entity unto itself, and really has come to dominate triathlon in terms of the language. Mm. And I mean, that's great. I'm glad to see so many people getting into the sport to do an Ironman. But I think, unfortunately, it's created, as you and I were talking earlier, this bucket list sort of thing where people get in and they do one race and then they get out. And I think it's wonderful that people accomplish it and consider it the accomplishment that it is, because it is a fantastic accomplishment. But I hope that most people who get in realize that there are shorter distances, because there are so many terrific local race organizers that are doing the short races. And, you know, people who do Ironman, I hope come to learn along the way that the shorter distances are just as much fun and just as rewarding. And frankly, take so much less of your time and dedication to be able to participate in, and are, you know, equally worthy accomplishments.
Well, that's good. You pulled me around nicely there, Jeff, because I do have a tendency to go off on a tangent sometimes. And that was the second part of that, is that it's progressed from building up in stages to straight in. And it's not just straight in. You know, here in Europe, we have Ironman Lanzarote, which Paula Newby-Fraser said was the toughest Ironman in the world. And I've had people come to me saying, right, I'm doing my first triathlon. It's going to be Ironman Lanzarote. And then the sad thing is that when they don't do an Ironman in a particular year, they say, oh, I'm downgrading myself this year to do a half or to do a standard. But actually, they're just shorter. And like you say, that you can have great fun and they don't occupy your whole life. You can recover a lot quicker. You can get on with things the next day instead of having to sort of take a 4-day time out before you can walk again.
Yeah. And it's interesting because for many, many years, I only did halves, and I have come to really love the half Ironman distance. You know, I do multiple halves in a year, and I'll do one, maybe two Ironmans in a year. And, you know, my training for the half is obviously at a different intensity and a slightly different volume. And then I'll just ramp it up to get to the Ironman sort of distance. But, you know, the thing, you know, I've come to enjoy the Ironman. It wasn't something I enjoyed for a long time, but in the last few years, I actually really enjoy the Ironman because my fitness and my consistency is such that now I can race an Ironman. But in the past, I would race the halves and just complete the fulls. Now I can race both distances, but you know, you approach them differently. And I definitely race the half at a different intensity, and I'm not able to put in the time required to be able to race an Ironman at the same intensity as I do a half. So for me, I still enjoy the halves very much. I find them to be a great challenge, but one that is very worthy of the effort. And in a year that I don't do an Ironman and I just do halves, I don't consider that to be a downgrade at all. I consider that to be a very successful year if I've done well.
Yeah, absolutely. And ultimately, it's not about the medal of the race, is it? It's just being the best you can be, challenging yourself, getting out of your comfort zone. That's that. And I think probably that's something that we've all learned a little bit more about ourselves in the last year. You know, so and I mean, maybe that's, you know, you've really got three hats, haven't you, when we chat today, because you've got your physician's hat and you've got your own personal hobby there of the triathlete hat, but you're also a coach. And I guess this year has been triply challenging for you then, you know, because you've had to deal with your own disappointments, you've had to deal with the disappointments of your athletes, but then you've had to deal with those other horrors of sort of telling a family that their loved ones have just passed away.
So I have to say that, you know, it's been incredibly rewarding and very complimentary to have those other two things, because, I also had, you know, besides just my personal experience as a triathlete, we had personal, you know, turmoil within my own family. My daughter, who was 10 last year, was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. So we had to deal with, you know, a cancer diagnosis at the same time as this pandemic was raging, and I was working on the front line. So, you know, we've had to deal with a ton of things. And if not for the ability to get into my basement and get on the bike for an hour or get on the treadmill or run outside, if not for the ability to have my athletes to work with, I would be a mess. I mean, you know, we've been under incredible amounts of stress as emergency physicians and emergency providers, as all healthcare workers have. It's been a really, really tough year. And for me, I can 100% say that my mental health and my mental well-being is rooted in the ability to at least have an hour a day to be able to just, you know, forget it and just focus on training, and to help my athletes do the same. I've had several, I actually increased the number of athletes I had this year because people came to me looking for a way to stay focused, a way to be distracted, and a way to make sure that they maintain their motivation. And that's been really rewarding for me. And those relationships that I've formed with my athletes have been really the foundation of, like I said, my mental health.
Yeah. it's definitely gives you something else to focus on, doesn't it, when you're looking after other people rather than having to think about your own troubles. And I've felt, you know, that most of my athletes at some time have had some wobbles, some more than others, but I don't think anyone's escaped unscathed in terms of their mental health.
No, it's been really tough. I mean, I talked on my podcast, I reviewed a paper that looked at people's exercise and diet during lockdowns. And, you know, the people who stayed the most active did the best with their mental health and did the best with their diet. People who, you know, I mean, it's normal. I mean, we're emotional creatures and we've always used food as an outlet for mental distress. And people who kind of, you know, were having the most mental health issues turned to comfort foods and turned away from exercise and suffered the most in terms of their fitness and weight. And it was a really interesting paper. And we've seen a lot of that in healthcare as well. And, you know, I'm hopeful that coming out of this, one of the other things we've seen actually is that people, in order to maintain their mental health as much as possible, as soon as, you know, the lockdowns ended and it turned, the weather turned nicer in the Northern Hemisphere, bike sales went through the roof. Bike shops have been unable to keep bikes on the floor because they've been selling out to people who've never wanted bikes before. And so we've seen this turn from people who were previously sedentary just to get out of their houses have purchased bicycles. And so there's an opportunity here to turn these casual cyclists into potentially, you know, avid cyclists or triathletes. And so there's real opportunity here to leverage post-pandemic to take some of these folks and turn them into, you know, enthusiasts for our sport, if not for cycling.
Tell me about your coaching then. At what point in your triathlon journey did you decide to become a coach, and what was the catalyst there?
So I've been writing for different triathlon publications from a medical and health perspective for many, many years. I started doing that almost as soon as I started into the sport. The sport gave me so much and I wanted to try and give back. So I was at a triathlon camp pretty early on and I had the good fortune of meeting a writer for Inside Triathlon and started writing for their website and then eventually for print, and then leveraged that to make a connection with Triathlete magazine and have been an off and on medical contributor for Triathlete for almost two decades. And now I'm a contributor for the website, Triathlete magazine's website. So I've been doing that for a really long time, and about 5 years ago kind of was chatting with my wife saying how, you know, I'm, you know, into my 50s now. I love what I do. I love being an emergency physician, but I really want to think about being able to step back from that at some point and be able to maybe move into part-time as a physician. And in order to do that before I'm 65, I'm going to need to have some kind of secondary source of income. So what else can I do? And I thought about a couple of different things. And the thing that felt kind of got me most excited was the idea of becoming a triathlon coach and leveraging my experience in the sport, my niche, if you will, as an emergency physician and somebody who's been contributing as a medical, you know, writer for many, many years. Why not try my hand as a coach? And so I started my podcast, the TriDoc podcast, which I've been doing now for almost 2.5 years. And just as a means to kind of get my name out there, and then started my coaching business, which was initially TriDoc Coaching. And I've known Lance Watson, who is one of the Ironman Master Coaches. I've known him it's funny, I met him at the same camp where I met that Inside Triathlon reporter like two decades ago. And Lance and I have had a acquaintanceship over many, many years. Wherever I'd run into him, he's always been incredibly gracious, and we'd have nice long chats. And so around 6 months ago, I reached out to Lance and asked him if he would consider unofficially, kind of informally mentoring me as a coach. And after that relationship was going on for a few months, he was you know, nice enough to ask me to join his company at Life Sport Coaching. And I was thrilled, very honored to be thought of that way. And I joined Life Sport and now have been a member of Life Sport Coaching with Lance Watson and their other coaches there for the last 4 or 5 months. And so it's just been It's been a really rewarding. I love being a coach. Like I said, I love the relationships. I love watching the successes of my athletes, and I love being a part of that. It's, you know, after 2 decades in the sport, I've learned so much about so many things, and being able to, you know, be a part of helping my athletes, you know, skip all of the growing pains that I had to go through, and just sort of, you know, shortcut them to, look, these are the mistakes I made, so you don't have to make them. Let's just talk about, you know, the different things that I have done that met success, and you could try them.
Do you think that your background, because I would say most, yeah, the majority of coaches that I know are triathletes, either were or are still competing, but there aren't many who are doctors. Do you think that your background as a physician gives you any advantages? Do you think that influences the way in which you coach?
I think it, I hesitate to say it gives me a huge advantage, because I don't think you need a medical degree to be a good and successful coach. But I will say that I think it gives me an insight that, you know, other coaches can't possibly have, simply because I understand injuries. I understand rehab from injuries probably better than most. I understand the science behind all of the stuff that's marketed towards athletes. And I'm constantly having people asking me questions about, you know, the different products that are marketed to them. And it's, you know, that's what I do on my podcast, is I basically spend almost half of every podcast looking at the claims that different manufacturers make, and I can look at the evidence and give an objective viewpoint of whether or not it makes sense. But I could do that for my athletes in a much more detailed manner. And the big thing, I think, is also as an athlete who's been in the sport for 20 years, you know, I've dealt with a lot of the common injuries, and I've rehabbed them successfully because of being a physician. I understand, and I understand what's involved in making sure those injuries don't happen again. So I think, to answer your question, yes, I have an advantage as a physician, but it's not like you need a medical degree necessarily to have that.
So here's the next question, because coaches are terrible for doing what they ask others to do, aren't they? You know, do as I say, but not as I do. So do you follow your own advice, both physical and medical, in terms of preparation and recovery?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's, I am as competitive as they come. There, you know, I have a coach, because I don't trust myself to be my own coach. It's not like I couldn't do my own routines or give myself my own workouts. I could. I just believe that I need an outside, you know, I need someone outside who can be objective and look and say, hey, you know, clearly you need to take a recovery day, you know, because I'm not going to be able to do that. I provide that for my athletes, but I need someone to provide that for me. That being said, if I'm sick, if I feel a niggle or an injury or something like that, I'm quite good at, you know, I don't feel guilty about taking time to recover. I had a back injury a couple of weeks ago. I was doing so well with my running. I was having great run block going on. And then I did a brick workout where I developed some back spasms. And I told my coach, I said, look, I know from history where I've tried to run through this, that if I try to run through this, I'm going to spend more time recovering than if I just shut it down. And so I did. I just shut down the running. I focused on biking and swimming. And within 10 days, I was back to running again. So yeah, I do. I try very hard to listen to my own advice.
Interesting what you say there about feeling guilty or not feeling guilty, because one of the things that I have been talking around with athletes is something my brother teaches, mindful self-compassion. And we talk, do you know Mark Bubbs, the guy who wrote Peak?
I don't, but I've heard a lot about mindful self-compassion.
Well, we'll talk about Mark Bubbs after the show, but he was a guest of mine recently. He's a great chap, and the book's great as well. But he writes a section in the back of his book there about mindful self-compassion and, you know, giving yourself permission to back off, giving yourself permission to do this. And actually, there's quite a lot of evidence. You're probably more familiar with it than I am, but that shows that those people who are able to be self-compassionate are actually build more resilience than those people who just sort of go, you know, suck it up, buttercup. You know, the no pain, no gain fraternity, who I'm at great pains to distance myself from. So, and of course, during the lockdown, during the whole of the COVID pandemic, there's been a lot of guilt from people, and perhaps people criticizing themselves and unfairly being harsh on themselves when we perhaps do need to give ourselves a little bit more, you know, a little bit more self-compassion to have a day off if you're not feeling it, whether that's emotional or physical.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting. I should mention, I think your mic is rubbing against your sweatshirt.
Yeah.
I should, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I actually mentor high school students, and I'm part of a group here in Colorado called Minds Matter Colorado. And we mentor high school students who are academically doing extremely well, but maybe disadvantaged because of socioeconomic class or race. And so we're working with them to get them a leg up to try and get them to achieve whatever they can. And we talk a lot about mindful self-compassion, and it has important roots in really everything that you do. But I can't agree enough that in athletics, it's just as important, because I see so many times that athletes who feel guilty about taking that day off or are hard on themselves because they didn't have, you know, the workout they wanted on the day that they need, like the FTP test is a great example. It's like, I crapped the, you know, I did such a terrible job on that FTP test. I'm a terrible person. I'm like, no, you're not. It's fine. You know, it's just a workout. It's in the grand scheme of things, it just doesn't matter. It's like, it's just one day. And I think, like you said, the people who are less hard on themselves have the most success overall.
Yeah.
And that's what's important.
Well, let's rewind then. You talked about your experience with the pilots. I presume he was okay in the end.
Yeah, he was. He was pretty sick when we saw him, but he did okay.
Good. Well, I'm sure people would have been thinking, well, why didn't you ask how he was? So there we go. We know he survived that one. Tell us about COVID. Tell us about what you've learned about COVID. I mean, we're probably all quite aware of the various things now, but I'm still not sure some people get that it's how serious it is. You know, I've got a sense that some people who I know are having the vaccine think that once they've had the vaccine, they can go back to behaving how they used to do, and that, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. And, you know, so, and also there's a lot of people that haven't had the vaccine, and it's still going to, and, you know, most of the experts that I've heard speak say that we're going to have to learn to live with this thing. So just give us a brief snapshot of coronavirus and why it's worse than the flu and why we should consider it as more than just a conspiracy theory.
Yeah. How long do you have? You know, we're at a really dangerous point right now. You mentioned we're recording this March the 8th, so it'll be interesting, you know, to look back at this maybe in a couple of months and see what actually comes to pass. But I say that because, you know, places in Europe have done really well with lockdowns, and I recognize that lockdowns are so difficult. They're mentally difficult. They're difficult on our kids. They're difficult on everyone. But here in the United States, where even the bare minimum of things like wearing a mask and social distancing are viewed somehow as infringing on our rights, and you know, more than minor inconveniences, they're viewed somehow as, I don't even know how to put it, but they're viewed somehow as just, you know, the wrong thing to do, even though they are, you know, for the betterment of taking care of each other and you know, thinking long term. We're at a dangerous point right now because case levels are falling, vaccination rates are going up. And it's when, you know, it's when case rates have fallen, historically, we've seen over the last year that everybody kind of goes, oh, we're done. We could just, you know, go back to being normal. Let's open up the pubs. Let's go back to restaurants. Let's let's just pretend that we're all over this. And that's when we see this thing come back with a vengeance. And we know that right now we're at particular risk of that because of the new variants that are coming out and displacing the original viruses, which were much less infectious as they were. So, you know, what have we learned about this virus? So, you know, back in 2003, when the original SARS virus emerged in Asia and scared the bejesus out of everybody because of its lethality, at that point, that virus was killing something like 30% of those that it infected and was much less infectious than this current virus. Everybody freaked out. Everybody was terrified. But the virus just kind of went away. And now we're faced with a virus that is significantly much more infectious. And while it is less lethal, it is still very lethal. We're talking about a virus whose overall mortality is somewhere in the range of 1% to 2%, which, and I hate when people compare this to the flu, because there are several reasons why this is not the flu. So let's just get that out of the way. Number one, influenza is seasonal. This is not. This sticks around, and this causes death and illness throughout the year. Less in the summer, no question, but still significantly more than the flu. Number two, influenza tends to cause illness and death predominantly in the very young and the very old. Coronavirus causes illness and death in all ages at significantly higher rates than influenza. And number three, this disease is much more infectious. Influenza is an infectious disease. It has a very high what is called R-naught, which is the number that is used to describe infectivity, but the coronavirus R-naught is even higher. And especially with the variants, the R-naught is higher even still. So the B117, which is the one that was originally identified in the UK, the P1, which comes out of Brazil, and now the new California variant, the variants from South Africa, much, much more infectious. So all of those make it significantly different from influenza. The other things that we've learned that make this virus different from influenza is that when you get influenza, you're very sick for a week. If you survive, you'll recover, and then a week later you'll be back to normal and you're not going to have any problems. Not the case with coronavirus. We know that people who get sick from coronavirus, now I'm not talking about asymptomatic infections, I'm talking about those who actually get particularly ill, specifically those who end up in a hospital, but even those who just get sick at home. People who have coronavirus have significant risks for what we call post-COVID syndrome. Anywhere from 60 to 80% of patients who survive COVID are going to end up with months, upwards, some have even had it for a year, of very significant, sometimes debilitating symptoms. And we believe that some of these things might be lifelong. That is not the case with influenza.
Is this where you're talking about long COVID then? That's what they've been calling it in the UK, at least.
Yeah, I've not heard that term, but I would imagine that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm familiar with the fact that if people have the flu, and as triathletes, and as a coach, what I've experienced is that when people have got rid of their symptoms, the coughing and they feel a bit better, doesn't mean their immune system's strong enough to cope with training, but they start back again and they go back in fairly quickly, and then they start to develop fatigue and they get sore throats and headaches, and these things come back and they seem to last a long time, and maybe they end up with a post-viral syndrome. The post-COVID that you talk about is far worse then. I mean, what I've heard is pulmonary damage, so damage to lungs, but myocarditis from inflammation of the heart, and then I guess there'd be a whole load of other complications that sort of spin out from that.
Yeah, so post-influenza type stuff is usually just residual, it's because when you have the influenza, especially if you have severe influenza, your body takes a beating. I mean, the fighting off the infection and the autoimmune type of stuff that goes on, because that's what's happening. Your immune system is basically attacking your own cells trying to get rid of the virus. The recovery from that takes some time. It can take a few weeks. And depending on how severe your influenza was, you might be coughing, you might be fatigued, like all the things you mentioned. But with COVID, it's much different than that. We don't exactly understand what's going on, but COVID, it gets into everything. It gets into your brain, it gets into your heart, it gets into your lung, it gets into your blood, it gets in everywhere. And the residual effects of that are the predominant effect seems to be neurologic, in which people are reporting sleep disturbances for months. Mm-hmm. They're also reporting anxiety, depression. And then the physical manifestations, the most worrisome is the myocarditis that you mentioned. Worrisome because it's undetectable. It has caused sudden death in athletes. And we just don't have a great way to screen for it. A lot of cardiologists are suggesting if you've had COVID, even if you were asymptomatic, that you should get some kind of screening before you go back to athletics. That's probably overdoing it, but that's where it is for some people who are particularly risk averse right now.
It's really difficult when we're having this conversation, isn't it? Because you're speaking from the perspective of somebody who's experienced what happens to people who have COVID firsthand. You've seen a whole range of, you know, from death to just, you know, being a little unwell for a few days, and you understand from your medical training exactly what happens to the things that we can't see. And you're not being judgmental, you're being objective about this. And yet I know there were some people who were saying, well, you're being over dramatic, it's scaremongering, you know, saying that I might have a lifelong heart condition, saying that there might be things that last for a year, you know, I feel okay and I want to go back to triathlon. But I feel the same as you, is that as a coach, one of the things that I sign up to, almost like your what's the whole thing you sign, an Hippocratic oath that you sign up to doctors, is as coaches, we don't do anything that would place our athletes in harm's way. And to me, if you've had COVID and I'm even starting to prescribe training, then without any other information, I could be putting you in harm's way. So I make no apologies for being ultra cautious with people coming back from illness. You know, how would you answer those people who say, well, you're just scaremongering? And I know Bob, he's been okay with it, you know?
Yeah, how do I answer it? It's a tough one, because the thing is that we're dealing with so much that's unknown. The incidence, which is to say the number of people who will develop myocarditis after getting COVID, it remains completely unknown. We, you know, the reason that's unknown is because in order to know that number, we would actually have to take, let's say, 1,000 people who had COVID, and we would actually have to track them very carefully for months afterwards. And we just haven't had that study done. So we don't know. All we have right now is the reports that myocarditis is showing up very frequently, much more frequently than we would expect. So we don't know how to guide people. Instead, all we have are very worrisome statistics and very worrisome reports. And because of that, people are being very cautious. My own practice has been, if I have a young, healthy person who had COVID and was not particularly ill, I keep them off of training for 2 weeks, no training at all for 2 weeks. And I explain exactly why I'm concerned. I say, look, you know, even though you feel totally fine, even though your symptoms were minimal, these are the risks. COVID does affect the heart. We know that. You need 2 weeks to recover. And then once those 2 weeks are up, let's get back to very low zone 2 type training and let's see how it goes. And, you know, I'll ramp them up very slowly from that. And I tell them why. I think the biggest thing that coaches can do is communicate with their athletes and explain why they're doing thing. I find athletes get frustrated when you don't communicate. So that's what I do. I say, look, this is why I'm doing it. We're going to ramp up very slowly. I want to know about any unexpected shortness of breath or any unexpected palpitations. Either of those things happen, we're shutting it down. You're going to see a cardiologist to get screened for the myocarditis. That's the best you can do. And if somebody was hospitalized with COVID, they're not training until they get evaluated by a cardiologist.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my whole philosophy based around coaching now is about health first before training.
Yeah.
You know, and I make no apologies for that. I'm in this life to live it a long time to as full an amount as I can. And the only way I can do that is focus on my health first before training. And I've done the training first before health, and it usually doesn't have a good outcome if you carry on ignoring stuff.
Right, but you communicate that up front. I mean, you tell your athletes know what they're getting when they come with you. So I imagine they're not going to be surprised when you say, look, I can't do this right now because I'm concerned about your health. They won't be surprised because they know that that's the expectation. It's going to be the athlete who doesn't know that in advance and their coach suddenly springs that on them. Again, it just goes back to this idea of communication. It's very important.
When this whole thing kicked off, I know a lot of my triathlete friends were thinking, well, we're triathletes, you know, we've done Ironman, so obviously that makes us invincible for a start. You know, you get your little invincibility certificate when you cross the finish line. And so therefore, you know, and I've got a strong heart because I do triathlon and I train every day. And so therefore, I'm going to have a better immunity to this sort of thing than that guy on the street who doesn't exercise and he's a little bit overweight and he sits behind a desk all day. But are triathletes really that healthy? I don't know if you're familiar with the paper that Paul Larson and Phil Maffetone wrote about fit but unhealthy, which is where they looked at this particular whole particular debate.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with their paper, but I did recently just review an article on what's called reverse J curves in cardiovascular health, which basically looks at, you know, the more you train, the fitter you, or the healthier you become until you reach an inflection point where mm-hmm. more training actually decreases the health benefits.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I am familiar with the whole concept and it makes a lot of sense. That's not to say that more training is unhealthy. It just, you don't get quite as many benefits. You know, I think coronavirus, again, is different from influenza because influenza, it is true. If you're a healthier specimen going in, influenza is less likely to affect you. But coronavirus is completely indiscriminate. Yes, it is true. In certain age groups, you are much less likely to become seriously ill or to die. However, you're still much more likely to die from coronavirus than you are to die from any other infectious disease out there. And you're much, much more likely to contract coronavirus than any other infectious disease out there. So I would ask anybody who has that attitude, how lucky do you feel? Because that's basically what you're saying. You're saying, I feel lucky, and I'm going to say, I'm going to not take any, you know, listen, we're not asking a whole lot. I'm asking you to take some basic protective strategies. I don't think you need to go and run with a mask. I don't think you need to go and bike with a mask. But if you're going to go run with somebody else that you don't know, it's probably a good idea to have a mask on. If you're going to go bike and spend, you know, 2 hours riding directly behind somebody else, you should probably have some kind of face covering. But if you're doing those things by yourself, no, I don't think you need a mask. I don't think you need a buff or something covering your face for those activities. But listen, again, it all boils down to, you know, that Clint Eastwood movie, you know, how lucky do you feel? Because that's basically what people are saying when they say that this is, when they're being oblivious and saying this doesn't affect me. And
I mean, it's been going on for a year now. So I guess most people have probably changed their training habits anyway. You know, we've had no racing, but we've had lots of online racing. We've had people training at home, so they can't get out. But because they're frustrated, their events have been cancelled. They've been smashing it with weekly two, you know, races on Zwift. They've been doing Everesting challenges. They've been seeing King of the Mountain, fastest known times, all of that sort of stuff. So people have been training hard. And it seems to me like there's been two. So again, it's been polarized, hasn't it? There's the people who've eased back on the training and perhaps fallen into those bad habits you mentioned earlier. And there's the people who've absolutely gone overboard, maybe because it's a deflection of something else. But what sort of things do you think we should be, apart from what you've just mentioned about, you know, the wearing the mask, what sort of things do you think that we should perhaps still be mindful about when we're training, you know?
Well, I think there's a third group too. You know, there's the group that's kind of drifted away from training. There's the group that's gone on to like all of these like amazing challenges, which I think are fantastic. You know, there are some people that need things like that to motivate them. But then I think there is a third group and I fall into that third group. I don't need a challenge to motivate me. I grieved just like everybody else last year, where I kind of like went into this period of, you know, the seven stages of grief, just like everybody. And I lost my motivation for a little while, but I found it again. And for me, it came about in the forms of realizing that training for me is, you know, what keeps me sane and what gives me my, you know, my ability to blow off steam and my ability to come home after caring for all these dying patients and be able to forget that for an hour. And so I found my motivation again, and I've watched my TSS on Training Peaks go up, and it's been great. So I don't need those events online. They don't do anything for me, but I'm thrilled to see everybody else getting so much out of it. And it brings me great joy. I personally don't go for them, but that's fine. And I know there are a lot of people like me. So that's that third group. And then when you ask about what kinds of things we should avoid, I think people have to be very careful about going to the gym. Gyms, you know, especially if they're smaller rooms, they can be poorly ventilated. You have to watch out about sharing equipment. I mean, we know that coronavirus is not spread so much by touch. So we used to be really worried that, you know, if you shared a dumbbell after someone else, you'd be in great jeopardy. That's probably not the case. It seems to be much more of a respiratory spread. But, you know, when you're in a gym, we've seen cases of spin classes where the entire spin class got infected because one person had it, because everybody's breathing hard. So, you know, even with masks on, that's going to be potentially dangerous. So anywhere you're going to be clustered with other people, you want to be careful. And swimming, you know, swimming pools, the virus does not spread in the water, but you have to kind of look at where you're swimming. I personally, I'm very fortunate. I have an all year open outdoor pool. So I swim in my outdoor pool. I haven't had to swim indoors. If I had to swim indoors, I would do so in a large pool. Most pools are quite big, so ventilation is not that much of an issue. And as long as it's not super crowded in there, I think you're probably okay. But again, everybody has to make the choice of what's safe for them and has to do what they can to try and mitigate things. If you're vaccinated, clearly you're at a different level of what you can concern yourself with.
Do you think there's any need to worry, because there is evidence about what happens to your immune system when you've done a particularly long training session or a particularly hard training session, that it's suppressed for a period of time afterwards? Is that a concern, or doesn't it matter if we're training on our own?
I tell people all the time, the thing about immune suppression after big training efforts, it's real. We don't know how significant it really is, but it is real. But it's short-lived. I mean, the window for infectivity or for getting infected after that kind of... First of all, it has to be a very high effort and it has to be really prolonged. I mean, we're talking more than 2 or 3 hours. So it's got to be something like 5-6 hours before you really see that decrease in immune function. And it's not like you're going to get, if you're by yourself. So if you do one of these events, if you're doing something in your house, like on the trainer, and you then stay home for the next 2 days, you don't have a roommate or something like that, then you're fine. Because you it's not just like if you get immune suppressed, you don't get infected by things that are inside of you. You have to be exposed. So it takes both the immune suppression and the exposure in order to get sick. As long as you're not being exposed, I haven't told any of my athletes to change anything related to those kinds of things, because none of them right now are doing any of those kinds of super long events anyways.
Okay. So going forward then, assuming we all get the vaccine fairly soon, sometime this year, what habits should we retain? You know, we've learned, I think, that perhaps when we go to crowded places, when we're sitting on public transport, perhaps when we're going on aeroplanes, that perhaps we need to wear masks a bit more. Do you think we should continue with that? I think we've all learned that hand washing is far more important than we all know about hand washing, but come on, how many people actually do it religiously? You know, I'm sick of going into service stations in the UK and seeing guys just standing at the urinals and then walking straight out and that sort of thing. You know, so what sort of habits do you think we should continue with once this is...
Well, let me ask you this. When's the last time you had a cold?
The last time I had a cold, yeah, a long time ago.
I work at an emergency department. I haven't had a cold in over a year. Mm-hmm. That is unheard of. And all of my colleagues are the same way. When somebody shows up with the sniffles, our first question is, oh my God, do you have COVID? And they say, no, I got tested. But then everybody remarks on, wait a minute, you have a cold. How's that even possible? Yeah. None of us have had colds. It's been so long. And now when somebody shows up at work with a cold, none of us are even particularly worried, because A, they're wearing a mask, and B, none of us are like, we're all washing our hands. I mean, we all wash our hands anyways, but the thing is, you know, usually once somebody shows up at work with a cold, it spreads around pretty quickly. But because that person's wearing a mask now all the time, it doesn't. So what I would like to see change, but you know, it's funny because they said this after 1918 too, and things didn't change after 1918.
That's the Spanish flu, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I would imagine that handshaking is probably done. You know, this has gone on long enough that I would think we're probably done with shaking hands. Shaking hands is by far the number one way that we spread respiratory viruses. So, I'd be fine if we never shake hands again. We'll see if that sticks. Yeah, exactly. Elbows, fist bumps, that kind of stuff. Second thing, I think hand washing is probably pretty ingrained now. Hand sanitizers are going to be everywhere, and I would not be surprised to see that come into common usage. I don't know about masks. I think masks have, especially here in the United States, where masks for some stupid reason have taken on a political, you know, vibe, which really it's beyond stupidity, but it's there. I don't think you're going to see masks retain, stay in the public conscience, but it's really too bad. I think in the emergency department, they will. I hate getting colds. So it's been wonderful to go a whole year. I mean, when I get colds, I can't train, and you know, it's been great to not be sick for a year.
Yeah, I have that same thing. when you have a cold, you feel rubbish. I hate feeling rubbish, so I don't want to get a cold. I'd rather take a few days off training than get a cold and have to miss a whole week.
I got to tell you, just on that, you know, my kids are in school. My younger kids are in school, but they're wearing masks and they're doing hand sanitizing all the time, and they haven't had a cold in over a year. Mm. So there is something legit to this, and not getting colds for that long of a time is a pretty big deal.
There's probably something cultural about the mask wearing as well, isn't there? You know, I mean, I remember seeing Japanese and Chinese tourists that would walk around London with the masks on and thinking, well, I wonder what they're worried about catching. And then thinking, well, perhaps they've got a cold and they don't want to pass it on to everybody else. I wonder also if it's going to be based on different countries. So you'll go to some countries where wearing a mask is more accepted and where it's more required as well.
Well, I think so part of the Asian experience also is their cities are much more polluted, especially in China. And so I think the mask wearing also has a pollution mitigation fact or point there. But I wouldn't be surprised if it becomes a more commonplace expectation that if you're sick, you don't come to work.
Yeah.
Right now it's been the expectation that, you know, you come to work no matter what, unless you're dying or you have like a very high fever or whatever. But I wouldn't be surprised if that changes. You know, working remotely now has become much more easy to do and much more acceptable. So maybe in the future it becomes, look, you've got a cold, don't come in, don't expose everybody else, stay home. And wearing a mask might also become something like, hey, you got the sniffles, just put on a mask and be thoughtful for everybody else. These are all things that they're common sense. There's things we probably should have been doing for a long time. And if it took a pandemic to actually make them stick, I mean, I don't want to have gone through the pandemic, but I'd be happy if they stuck after this.
Yeah, and that whole thing about if you're ill, unless you're dying, come to work. We know that germs are passed on. It doesn't make any logical sense, does it? And certainly as a doctor, you're probably like, what the hell?
Yeah.
What about supplements, you know, in terms of maintaining health? Do you believe that there are any supplements? I mean, I've heard several people saying vitamin D, particularly for those of us who live in the sun-starved parts of the Northern Hemisphere in the winter. You know, certainly where I live in the UK, we're just coming around to the spring solstice now and the sun will start to get higher and stronger. But up until now, it's been pretty gloomy. Vitamin D supplementation's generally well recommended.
I mean, I just reviewed the science on this recently, another article I wrote for Training Peaks on vitamin D. And, you know, the science on vitamin D is pretty weak. There's really not a lot of reason to be taking vitamin D. There's no question vitamin D is the sunshine vitamin. As long as you have a certain amount of sun exposure, then you're going to produce more than enough in your skin and you definitely don't need to take supplements. What you just said about during the winter months is what a lot of people will repeat as kind of the gospel, that during the winter, I really need to take vitamin D. Well, the reality is the reason rickets, which was the bone disease that is the manifestation of vitamin D deficiency, came to be had nothing to do with winter. It had to do with the fact that England's summer skies were blotted out by, you know, coal-fired plants. And so even during the summer, children weren't getting exposed to enough sunshine because they were either in the factories or they were outside underneath a sky that was darkened by the smoke coming from the plants. So we don't actually think that there is much of a risk of vitamin D deficiency, even in the Northern Hemisphere right now, because so much of our diet is actually fortified with vitamin D. Most people who drink milk in the Northern Hemisphere get plenty of vitamin D in their milk. That goes for milk substitutes as well. Fish has a lot of vitamin D in it. But that being said, you know, taking vitamin D supplements, as long as you're taking it in the recommended allowance, is not harmful. And I don't discourage people from using it if that's something they feel is of benefit. But I will say vitamin D confers no protection against any illness. It's never been shown to be protective in any way against anything. The only thing it protects against is rickets. And we haven't seen a case of rickets in the Western world in almost a century now, and people have not been supplementing with vitamin D during all that time.
Okay. Interesting update then. Anything else? Any other supplements or foodstuffs that you are very keen on and promote amongst your athletes and in your own sort of daily nutrition?
I spend a lot of time reviewing supplements.
Yeah.
As you might imagine, they're the thing that are pushed pretty much the hardest. I've reviewed creatine, beta-alanine, branched chain amino acids, beet juice. Oh my gosh, I've reviewed so many things. There's very little science to suggest that any of them are particularly helpful.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, none of them. Unfortunately, none of them justify the costs. There may be some benefit for beetroot juice, but it's very marginal and not very long lasting, but it's very healthy. So I certainly have no problems with people using beetroot juice. I think that's fine. The one thing that has been shown absolutely without a doubt to be performance enhancing and reduce all cause mortality, caffeine. And I highly recommend people drink coffee or get caffeine in some form. The benefits of caffeine are very reproducible. It turns out to be about 2.5% across the board, both in terms of aerobic, anaerobic, power numbers, whatever you want. And the numbers coming out on reductions in cardiovascular deaths and all-cause mortality are really, really impressive. Now, these are all observational trials where they basically just, you know, they look at large populations over a long period of time and they ask them how much coffee they're drinking and they see how many of them die. So they're not the best quality studies, but they have been remarkably consistent. And people who drink more coffee are healthier. And, you know, what I said in the piece that I wrote was, and in my podcast, I basically said, look, you know, the thing about caffeine is we're all drinking it. We're all taking it. And the thing is if you're not using it, then you're showing up at the start line of a race with a 2.5% deficit. It's not like drinking caffeine is going to make you faster than anybody else because everybody's using it.
Well, that's some interesting things. I know I've had a couple of guests who've recommended creatine. Dr. Tommy Wood talked about it as a brain protectant. You know, it's...
Yeah, the data on that is really soft. I know okay. there's been some studies on post-concussion using creatine. The theoretical stuff is there. There's no question there's theoretical, but the actual evidence on this is not great. There are some studies that suggest that this is true, but none of it is particularly well designed. None of the trials are very large. And again, if people want to use creatine, I have no problem with it. Go ahead, use all the creatine you want. It bothers me not one bit. But just know that if you use creatine, you're going to be putting on weight because it drags a lot of water into your cells. And you're not going to be getting any particular performance benefit. In fact, you're not going to get any performance benefit. But if you're a bodybuilder, a lot of bodybuilders like creatine because it adds muscle mass. And, you know, I have no stake in any of these games. I just review I review the evidence and I report on the evidence. Most of the people who like creatine tend to be involved somehow with the supplement industry. I have no idea who Dr. Wood is, and he may have absolutely no involvement. But the studies that suggest creatine is helpful are almost always somehow tied back to the supplement industry.
Okay. Okay. Let's talk about wearing your three hats then. So you're going to have to take each one on and put it on and take it off very quickly here. In terms of what you've learned from the COVID pandemic as a physician, as a triathlete, and as a coach then. So, you know, I suppose that what you've learned there will help strategy. So you've probably talked about all this, but if you could just summarize some sort of top three things that you've learned.
Well, I think the thing I've learned from COVID is all negative, but that's probably based on where I live. As much as, you know, there's been some nice stories and some good news stuff about how people care about each other, I feel like in the grand scheme of things, people are, and I'm saying people in a global way, people are incredibly selfish. And it's that selfishness that has led to this pandemic going on for as long as it has, and has led to it being as severe as it has. It didn't have to be this way. It could have been much less horrible. And, you know, too many people keep saying, well, it hasn't affected me personally, so why am I having to do anything? And that is really, really sad. It hasn't affected me personally either. And yet, I show up to work and see families shattered every single day. Somebody died just last night. You know, young man with a family died from COVID. So that's the number one thing I've taken away from this, is that we are not as advanced as a society as I thought we were. As a triathlete, I realize that I used to think that I trained for finish lines. Mm. And now I realize that I don't. I train for start lines. I don't even care if there is a start line. I mean, I do. I mean, obviously I do because I want to race. But for me, the training is more than half the battle. For me, the training has, I needed this reminder in a way. God, I didn't need it. But, you know, if anything came out of it, is that I have realized that for me, the training is something that I enjoy so very much, and it is so important to me, and it is something that I will never again complain about or doubt or question as to why I do it. And then as a coach, it has given me such satisfaction and joy to be able to provide structure for athletes who feel as though that's something they need in their lives to have a sense of purpose. And that's been incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, I think I'd probably agree with all those. I mean, I'm not in your position for work. You know, this is my life coaching, but you know, I live by the canal. There's a walkway here. I've been incredibly uplifted to see all the people that you described going out and running and cycling, you know, and quite clearly a lot of them are new to this. And it's been amazing. At times it's been like a busy freeway, you know, when the sun's out. But I've also been incredibly frustrated and annoyed by the selfishness of people. You know, just yesterday, three couples sitting outside my house, you know, on the bench, on the front bench there, chatting away. The rules say that we're not supposed to be meeting people in public just yet, but everybody's decided that lockdown's ended 3 weeks before the Prime Minister's date, if that actually happens. Like you, I think I probably realized a long time ago, because I'd sort of stopped racing a while back, but still I do this because I love it. And if there were, and when there aren't any races, I would still swim and go and ride my bike and, you know, go running and discover places. And certainly the helping out. I felt also that as coaches, we're almost like that totem pole for people to gather around to provide them with a support and direction when they're sort of struggling and all at sea. And here we have a group of nearly 200 triathletes in my SWAT group. And I think once races started getting cancelled last year, we were getting requests for changes to training plans as people pushed back. You know, I'm doing this race now I'm doing this one. Some people requesting 10 or 12 changes over the course of 4 months. And it felt like everything was going to be different this year. But we've started off with a few races that have been binned already, and it feels like we might be doing that for a little while longer. But I think I probably echo most of your thoughts there. Let's step away from COVID for a little bit then, Jeffrey. You've said that you're in your 50s. I'm in my late 50s. One of my ambitions now is to still be doing the stuff that I do every day when I'm in my 70s. And I'm laying out a strategy, a 20-year strategy, with things that I'm doing now to enable me to do that. What sort of strategies do you follow and promote for long-term health and, you know, ambition, if you like?
Yeah, I coach a couple of athletes who are in their mid to late 60s, and they both have the same ambitions. And I think that it's definitely doable, especially these days, mostly because you have the ability to acquire important data that can monitor health. In terms of myself and in terms of these athletes, I think the most important thing is to recognize that it's not only possible, it's very, very probable that we can continue to train, you know, into our 70s. The thing is we have to acknowledge that our physiology changes, and we have to be willing to accept that we're not going to be able to do things in our 60s or 70s the way we did in our 30s, 40s, and even our 50s. So it means just adapting the model to accept that physiologic change, and just making sure that the athlete or yourself is okay with that. And if you're not, then you need to reconsider. Because if you expect to be able to do things the way you did when you were younger, you're going to be disappointed. Instead, you have to just accept that, you know what, I'm now 60 or 70. And so I'm still getting to train. I still love training. I'm just not going to train the same way. And what that means is less days of high intensity, a lot more days at lower intensity, and more days of recovery. Because when you do a high intensity day and you're in your 60s or 70s, you need a couple more, you know, you need at least a full more day to recover than you would if you were much younger. It doesn't matter what kind of condition you're in. It's just the nature of the game. Your muscle mass is decreased by the time you get to that age, and your ability to recover is also diminished. So as long as you're willing to accept that, then you can keep going. And I think you also have to recognize the wear and tear on joints. If you've been at the sport for a long time, means that you need to modify the amount of running that the person does. Now, some people are just natural, you know, have wonderful gait and are able to maintain high run volumes, you know, well into their 60s and 70s, but that is unusual. By the time most runners get to that age, they've sustained some kind of wear and tear injury, and so consequently, they have to run less. That doesn't mean they have to run less days. It just means they have to run less volume on, you know, the days that they run. So with those changes, and that's what I'm planning to do, just like you, you know, spend more time on my bike, more time on the pool, less time at the higher heart rates. And then the last thing I would say is more frequent health evaluations, because even if they are in great baseline health, it's the silent stuff, specifically cardiac, you know, buildup of plaque in the coronary arteries that can be detected with screening exams. I think once you get into your late 60s, it's important to consider those kinds of screening tests, especially for those who are at risk because they've got family history or other associated illnesses.
Yeah, I think, was it Ned Overend? I think Joe Friel quoted him in that book, Fast After 50, where he said, I still do the same training as I did when I was in my 30s. I just have to, it just takes me longer to accomplish it. So what I used to fit into a week now takes me 2 weeks to do.
Right.
But there's no reason to run away from high intensity training when you get older, is there? But just, you just have to be measured about it. And like you say, realize your limitations.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, listen, max heart rate comes down. So, you know, your zones shift, but as long as you make those accommodations, you're still training at higher intensity. It's just the intensity isn't as high as when you were 20 or 30.
I often have this conundrum that I keep forgetting to ask. So maybe I'll ask you this one. So we all know that, you know, from a certain point, you start in physical decline. It's perhaps from your early 40s, it's very slow. And then it speeds up as you get into your late 50s and what have you. At what point in your life do you accept that, let's say you've got an FTP of 250 this year, rather than trying to improve, if you can keep your FTP at 250 next year and you're 60, then that's like a 2% improvement. So at what point do you think that starts to kick in and we should be thinking more about maintaining what we have rather than trying to push the limits? Because that's when you start to get injured or ill, isn't it? When you're trying to push too hard to improve.
It's a great question. I don't have a good answer for you because I think it really depends. And I think we don't know. I know that I wrote an article for a triathlete like 15 years ago. I wrote an article where I talked about the decline, you know, the physiologic decline that is seen with aging. And I got a letter from an athlete who was in their 60s who just tore me a new one, super angry, talking about how this is not true. I continue to get better every year, blah, blah, blah. And I wrote back and I said, look, my article was not intended as a slight against you. My article was just reporting on the facts of nature. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean everybody's going to respond the same way. Well, that's true for this as well. I don't think we know how any individual is going to respond and when that particular fall off is going to occur in any particular individual. We know that everybody's going to have some kind of drop off, but we also know that what we used to think would be everybody would drop off in their 40s, that's not happening anymore. Mm. I continue to get faster. I'm 54 this year, and I've knocked time off my half Ironman and full Ironman time every single year. And that's not because I'm the only thing I'm doing differently is I'm training with more consistency and with more quality. And as I've told people, you asked me about supplements before, I don't use any supplements. I just train better. And if you train better, you don't need to use supplements, because if you train with more quality and more consistency, you're naturally going to get faster. So, you know, at some point I recognize I'm going to hit a plateau and that then I'm going to start to see some declines and I have to be okay with that. But like you said, as long, you know, at some point you have to just try to keep that plateau and eventually recognize the plateau comes down. I think we've seen, if you look at the age groups, you know, 55, 59, we continue to see that athletes' times will stay about the same as the 50 to 54 with maybe a slight decrease, but it's really in the next age group up with the 60 to 64 that we start to see the changes. So my guess is that it's somewhere in the range of 58 to 60 that you can expect that, you know, you're going to start to naturally see a bit of a decline.
All right. So it's coming to me quickly then, isn't it? I'm 57 now. So
Well, again, right? Everybody's different. So yeah. For you, it might be 65. Yeah, you know, you just never know.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, are you familiar with Simon Butterworth? He's from Boulder. Simon won his age group in Kona at the age of 72. So now I do think that sometimes that whole point about people improving their fitness is also to do with their longevity in the sport. If you stayed late or if you started late, then you've got a much better chance of keeping improving than if you started when you were in your 30s.
No question. The people who are super, super competitive in their 20s and 30s tend to get frustrated because they see the declines that come with their late 30s and 40s, and they often drop out of the sport. Whereas someone like me, who only really got into the sport in their 30s and then took like over 10 years to actually be able to train consistently and start to see improvements, there's no question. It's like, it's very rewarding for someone like me and easier to stay in the sport longer.
What are your thoughts about lifting weights as you get older?
It's so important. I have strength as a major, major component of training for all of my athletes, honestly, no matter what their age, but it's hugely important for older athletes because muscle mass, we know, declines with age, and strength training can maintain muscle mass and improve endurance performance. And it is, you know, there's a lot of talk about how strength training can reduce injuries. It's really hard to prove that, and I can't say that I've seen any really convincing studies for that one way or the other. I did recently see one study that talked about specifically strengthening the intrinsic muscles of the feet, of all things, that reduced running injuries of the leg. So that was a really interesting study. First one I've ever seen that really showed that strength training reduced injuries. But I'm a huge proponent of strength training.
My physio, who's worked with Olympic runners and a lot of the Olympic triathletes here in Leeds, believes that a lot of the running injuries that we get, and I think the statistics that she's compiled from the people who've been into her clinic are like 70 to 80% of triathlon injuries are running related and their lower limb. And there are three main reasons for these that she finds when she, you know, she has the intake questionnaires: increasing the volume too quickly, so doing too much too soon. Poor technique. So the way, you know, like 4 foot landing, you know, just pulls the injuries further down from the knee, and poor strength. And then she relates that poor strength is related to calf, related to heel raises. And so she'll get those people to do heel raises. And her threshold is generally 3 sets of 25 on a single leg. And most of those people that have had the calf or Achilles injuries are struggling to get anywhere near that. And so this sort of, it's anecdotal evidence, it's not research, but you know, Alison's at the top of her game, and she's been at it for a long time.
So, yeah, 100% agree with that. I would add a fourth, and that's poor footwear. You know, I think that this notion that, you know, there's been the pendulum on footwear, you know, too soft, too minimal. I mean, I'm not a proponent at all of the whole barefoot thing, because I think that that leads to foot injuries and everything else. But this idea of the concept behind barefoot running, which is to strengthen the intrinsic muscles of the feet, I think there's you know, there's real science behind that. And I think that is something we should all strive for. I just don't think we should do it by running. I think we should do it by doing dedicated strength exercises.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. In fact, I think I was probably one of those who read Born to Run, bought a pair of five-finger shoes, but I never ran on them. I was wearing orthotics at the time, and I decided I was going to use the five fingers to walk around in to strengthen my feet in the way you've done to wean myself off wearing orthotics. And so now I can run without orthotics. I think I may be going against the trend for most men in my 50s, because I used to get a lot of calf and Achilles problems. And with the guidance from my physio that I just mentioned, I've been able to run for 3 years now without any problems.
Yeah, well, proving the point right there.
Benjamin Button has been after me. What about some of the other strategies that we can use? We've talked about some of the things that we don't know. You know, I mean, as coaches, we're always talking to people about understanding your body and listening to your body. But there are things that even if you get an inkling that something's not right, that you can't measure without, say, if you wear a wristband, a Whoop wristband or an Oura ring, then you can measure your heart rate variability. If you wear a constant glucose monitor, you can measure your blood sugar 24/7. Are there any of those things that you have faith in, or are there none of those things you have faith in?
All right. Well, more data isn't necessarily more better. Yeah. I've talked about continuous glucose monitoring recently. I think continuous glucose monitoring is terrific if you have diabetes. If you don't have diabetes, continuous glucose monitoring is, I don't know what you expect. You're going to see that your glucose stays in a normal range, and then it's going to go a little above normal after you eat because that's the way it's supposed to be. But I'm not sure what you want. I talked in my podcast about Sankoff's paradigm of data. There are three reasons to gather data. The first is it's going to tell you something you don't already know, and it's a number you care about. The second is the data that you collect is somehow going to change your, the data is something you can, is actionable. And the third is the data is relevant to you and not to someone else. Mm-hmm. So continuous glucose monitoring doesn't satisfy any of those. It's a number that, quite frankly, you already know, unless you're a diabetic, in which case you don't know it. The second, you can't do anything about it because, so what? You know the number, but you can't do anything about it. And the third is it's really not for you anyways. It's for the company who made the device because it's not helping you. Heart rate variability is a little more complicated. I think the problem with heart rate variability, I think it's a really interesting metric. I don't use it myself because I think the problem with heart rate variability is the way it's being used. So heart rate variability is a measure of chaotic, this is going to get into the weeds a little bit, but heart rate variability is a measure of chaos, right? So we're measuring the beat-to-beat variability, and variability is a non-linear mathematics. So we're basically saying we're looking at variability and we're using that as a correlation to the interplay between our autonomic and our parasympathetic nervous systems. And we're saying, oh, if we have increased variability, then our parasympathetic system is winning out. And if we have decreased variability, then our autonomic system is winning out. The problem is that we're taking a nonlinear equation, variability, and we're then applying it in a linear fashion. Higher is better, lower is less better. You can't do that. Nonlinear chaos theory doesn't work in a linear fashion. And yet that's exactly what everybody is doing. So I think the problem with heart rate variability is that this is an example where we've got a metric. It's something that we can measure. I don't think we understand 100% how we should be using it. And yet people are putting the horse in front of the cart. Mm. I have had many, many athletes who come to me and say, my variability is low. I don't think I should do this workout. And I'll be like, how do you feel? Well, I feel great. I feel rested. Had a great night's sleep. Everything's great. I'm like, okay, how about you throw the heart rate variability number in the garbage then and go do your workout and see how you feel. And they'll go do their workout and they say, well, that went really well. And I'm like, okay, well, then your heart rate variability is not really the end all to be all, is it? And I've seen people who shall remain nameless who are huge proponents of heart rate variability. And they just spout off on Twitter all the time about HRV is everything. And I think the reality is that HRV is probably something, but I think that we don't know exactly what it is just yet. And so I hesitate to use it as anything more than just one more metric kind of in the background. And I think it should be taken into consideration, but not be used as a determinant of anything. Mm. But that's how I look at it.
No, and that's very interesting. I've been using the Whoop for a long time now, and I've had various conversations with people who've done a lot of research, published a lot of papers on heart rate variability. And generally, they'll say, yeah, you perhaps it's like triangulation when you're looking for navigation, you know, to know where you really are. You can't really say on one point, you need to sort of work it out from three points. And those other points are, how do you feel? What's your body telling you? Maybe your motivation to train, mood, you know, those three things, plus heart rate variability, but not one of them on their own. And one of my people get the idea that I don't like gadgets. Again, like you, I think data's great if you're going to use it properly. But I also think that a lot of people coming into sport, remember, I started doing triathlon in 1980s when there wasn't really anything more than a stopwatch to use. You know, a computer was like a little thing that went on the side of the hub with a little click that ticked a little lever as it went past to rack up how many miles you'd done or what speed you were going at. And so as I've seen the introduction of Garmin watches and polar heart rate monitors and power meters, what I've seen is people becoming more dependent on that and less able to tell how their body's feeling and listen to what the body's telling them. And yeah, like I say, I'm not against gadgets. I just think there's a process and an order here. And at first, learn what your body's telling you and then add the data to it to correlate that.
Absolutely. And I think what you just said about the heart rate variability just being one point and that you have to triangulate, that's so important. That really, to me, is the thing. And when I see all these people on social media just going on and on about it, it's like they're like cats following the laser dot, you know. It's like they're so excited and they it's just one more point that they're so convinced. And I don't even know what to say to that, because I think that they are genuinely earnest, but they are misinterpreting, and they're telling people the wrong thing, and it's not serving anybody.
I've been sort of reading about HRV for 3 or 4 years now. And what I've realized is that you start off, you realize it's a number, you realize it's about the variability of your heart, you know, and the way in which those sort of imply what's happening with the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems. But then you start reading about, well, sometimes higher doesn't necessarily good. You know, you could be in parasympathetic overdrive, and actually lower isn't necessarily bad, because that just shows that you've been training in the right direction and you need to back off. So that adds more complication. And then I speak to the real experts and they say, we don't use any of these algorithms, Simon. We just look at the raw data, root mean, sum squared difference. But they can interpret that. But of course, if you buy a gadget, then it has to interpret it and give you a figure to go along. And so that's where it's all getting a bit confusing.
Right. That's exactly it. It's the idea of, we can measure this, therefore we're going to foist it on people and let them do what they want with it. And that's where CGM is now coming too. CGM to me is a disaster waiting to happen. I have no idea what people are going to pretend to do with that, but I can see that there's a lot of people, you know, rubbing their hands with glee, thinking about how much money there is to be made on this. And I just feel bad for the athletes that are going to waste their time and money on it.
Well, there we go. Did we need to cover anything else today, Jeff? We've done a lot, haven't we? We've talked about COVID. We've talked about triathlon longevity. We've talked about the journey. I think we've got to know each other fairly well. Hopefully the listeners have got to get a flavor of the where you're coming from. And in the show notes, we'll point them to some of the articles that you've written. We'll also point them to your podcast. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So the TriDoc podcast has been going for about 2.5 years now, as I said earlier, and it's very much a labor of love. It comes from just encountering athletes with a lot of the questions that you've raised. People want to know whether or not they should be using supplements, whether or not they should be using different devices. They want to understand the injuries that they've had. And I just take the time that they don't have to do the research and come up with the evidence. And again, I don't have any sponsors. I don't take any money from anybody. And so I can give an objective viewpoint. And yeah. I work with a fellow by the name of Andrew Patterson, who runs the Iron Hacks blog out of Singapore. And he compiles a list of all of the different reviews I've given as to whether or not they're positive or negative, and keeps them on his website. And I, of course, keep them on everything can be found on my website, which is tridocpodcast.com.
Okay. And social media, where can people find you on there?
So I'm on Instagram at tridoccoaching, and that's all one word. And I'm also on the Twitter at triathmag tridoc. Triathlete Mag TriDoc.
Okay, well, we'll make sure those are all on the show notes. And then if there's any of those resources that you mentioned, any of the most significant research papers that you think might be interesting to readers, then you can let me have those after the show, and we'll put those on as well for those people who are interested in digging a bit deeper into COVID, post COVID, CGMs, what have you.
Sure thing. Be my pleasure.
Jeff, been brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on today. I hope your life improves as the coronavirus recedes and everybody gets the vaccinations and we get back to racing. It'd be interesting to see how that all pans out in 2021. It'd be nice to bump into you at a race somewhere, hopefully.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Boulder sometime and we can chat some more. And thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You're welcome. Thanks so much. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you to TriDoc for joining me on the High Performance Human Podcast. You can find links to just about everything we chatted about in the show notes below. Also, a reminder that if you are interested in being part of my SWAT Inner Circle, you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. Please email beth@thetriathloncoach.com or look for the link in the show notes below. So as always, we'll be back next week with another great guest, but for now, stay healthy and stay focused on being a high-performance human every aspect of your life.